Chapter 25. The Attack on the Hierajules. Though we were outdoors, where sounds are so easily lost against the immensity of the sky, I could hear the clatter Baldanders made as he feigned to struggle with his bonds. There were conversations in the audience, and I could hear those as well, one about the play, which discovered in it significances I had never guessed, and which Dr. Talos, I would say, had never intended. And another about some legal case that a speaker with the drawling intonation of an exultant seemed certain the Autarch was about to judge wrongly. As I turned the windlass of the rack, letting the pawl drop with a satisfying clack, I risked a sidelong look at those who watched us. No more than 10 chairs were in use, but lofty figures stood at the sides of the seating area and behind it. There were a few women in court dresses, much like the ones I had once seen in the House Azure, dresses with very low décolletages and full skirts that were often slit or relieved with panels of lace. Their hair was simply dressed, but it was set off with flowers, jewels, or brilliantly luminous larvae. Most of those in our audience seemed men, and more arrived momentarily. Many were as tall as, or taller than, Vodalus. They stood wrapped in their cloaks, as though they were chilled by the soft spring air. Their faces were shadowed beneath broad-brimmed, low-crowned petticoats. Baldander's chains fell with a crash, and Dorcas shrieked to let me know he was free. I turned toward him, then cowered away, wrenching the nearest flambeau from its socket to fend him off. It guttered as the oil in its bowl nearly drowned the flame, sputtering to renewed life when the brimstone and mineral salts Dr. Talos had gummed around the rim took fire. The giant was feigning madness, as his role required. His coarse hair hung about his eyes, and they, behind its screen, blazed so wildly I could see them despite it. His mouth hung slack, drooling spittle and showing his yellow teeth. Arms twice the length of my own groped toward me. What frightened me, and I was frightened, I admit, and wished heartily I had Terminus Est in my hands instead of the iron flambeau, was what I can only call the expression beneath the lack of expression on his face. It was there, like the black water we sometimes glimpse moving beneath the ice when the river freezes. Baldanders had found a terrible joy now in being as he was. And when I faced him, I realized for the first time that he was not so much feigning madness on the stage as feigning sanity and his dim humility of it. I wondered then how much he had influenced the writing of the play. Though it may be only that Dr. Talos had, as he surely had, understood his patient better than I. We were not, of course, to terrify the Autarch's courtiers, as we had the country people. Baldanders would wrest the flambeau from me, pretend to break my back, and end the scene. He did not. Whether he was as mad as he pretended, or was genuinely enraged at our growing audience, I cannot say. Perhaps both those explanations are correct. However that might be, he jerked the flambeau from me and turned on them, flourishing it so the burning oil flew about him in a shower of fire. My sword, with which I had threatened Dorcas's head a few moments before, lay near my feet, and I stooped for it instinctively. By the time I had straightened up again, Baldanders was in the midst of the audience. The flambeau had gone out, and he swung it like a mace. Someone fired a pistol. The bolt set his costume afire, but must have missed his body. Several exultants had drawn their swords, and someone, I could not see who, possessed that rarest of all weapons, a dream. It moved like Tyrian smoke, but very much faster, and in an instant, it had enveloped the giant. It seemed then that he stood wrapped in all that was past and much that had never been. A gray-haired woman sprouted from his side, A fishing boat hovered just over his head, and a cold wind whipped the flames that wreathed him. Yet the visions, which are said to leave soldiers dazed and helpless, a burden to their cause, did not seem to affect Baldanders. He strode forward still, and the flambeau smashed clear a path for him. Then, in the moment more that I watched, for I soon recovered enough self-command to flee that mad fight, I saw several figures throw aside their capes, and, as it appeared, their faces too. Under those faces, which when they were no longer worn, seemed of a tissue as insubstantial as that of the nodules, were such monstrosities as I had not thought existence could support. A circular mouth, rimmed with needle teeth. Eyes that were themselves a thousand eyes, clustered like the scales of a pine cone. Jaws like tongs. These things have remained in my memory, as everything remains, and I have stared again at them in the dark watches of the night. I am very glad when at last I rouse myself to turn my face toward the stars and moon-drenched clouds instead, that I could see only those nearest our footlights. I have already said that I fled, but that slight delay, during which I picked up Terminus Est and stood observing Baldander's mad attack, almost cost me dearly. By the time I turned to take Dorcas to safety, she was gone. I ran then, not so much from Baldander's fury, or from the Cacogens in the audience, or from the Autarch's Praetorians, who I felt would surely arrive soon, but in pursuit of Dorcas. Searching for her and calling her name as I went, I found nothing but the groves and fountains and abrupt wells of that endless garden. And at last, winded and with aching legs, I slowed to a walk. It is impossible for me to set down on paper all the bitterness I felt then. To have found Dorcas and lost her so soon seemed more than I could bear. Women believe, or at least often pretend to believe, that all our tenderness for them springs from desire, that we love them when we have not for a time enjoyed them, and dismiss them when we are sated, or, to express it more precisely, exhausted. There is no truth in this idea, though it may be made to appear true. When we are rigid with desire, we are apt to pretend a great tenderness in the hope of satisfying that desire, but at no other time are we in fact so liable to treat women brutally, and so unlikely to feel any deep emotion but one. As I wandered through the nighted gardens, I felt no physical need for Dorcas, though I had not enjoyed her since we had slept in the fortress of the Demarchi, beyond the sanguinary fields, because I had poured out my manhood again and again with Jolenta in the Nenuphar boat. Yet if I had found Dorcas, I would have smothered her with kisses. And for Jolenta, whom I had been prone to dislike, I now had conceived a certain affection. Neither Dorcas nor Jolenta appeared, nor did I see hastening soldiers, or even the revelers we had come to entertain. The Thiasis, it seemed clear, had been confined to some certain part of the grounds, and I was now far from that part. Even now I am unsure how far the House Absolute extends. There are maps, but they are incomplete and contradictory. There are no maps of the Second House, and even Father Anir tells me that he has long ago forgotten many of its mysteries. And wandering its narrow corridors, I have seen no white wolves. But I have found stairs leading to domes beneath the river, and hatches opening into what appears to be untouched forest. Some of these are marked above ground by ruinous, half-overgrown marble steles. Some are not. When I have closed such hatches and retreated regretfully into an artificial air still laced with the odors of vegetable growth and decay, I have often wondered whether some passage or other does not reach the citadel. Old Ultan hinted once that his library stacks extended to the House Absolute. What is that but to say that the House Absolute extended to his library stacks? There are parts of the second house that are not unlike the blind corridors in which I searched for Triskel. Perhaps they are the same corridors, though if they are, I ran a greater risk than I then knew. Whether these speculations of mine are rooted in fact or not, I had no notion of them at the time of which I write now. In my innocence, I supposed that the borders of the House Absolute, which extended both in space and in time so much further than the uninformed would guess, could be strictly delimited, and that I was approaching, or would soon approach, or had already passed them. Thus I walked all that night, directing my course northward by the stars. And as I walked, I reviewed my life in just the way I have so often attempted to prevent myself from doing while I waited for sleep. Again, Draught and Rosh and I swam in the clammy cistern beneath the bellkeep. Again, I replaced Josephina's toy imp with the stolen frog. Again, I stretched forth my hand to grasp the haft of the axe that would have slain the great Vodalus and so saved a Thecla not yet imprisoned. Again, I saw the ribbon of crimson creep from under Thecla's door, Malrubius bending over me, Jonas vanishing into the infinity between dimensions. I played again with pebbles in the courtyard beside the fallen curtain wall, as Thecla dodged the hooves of my father's mounted guard. Long after I had seen the last balustrade, I feared the soldiers of the Autarch. But after some time, when I had not so much as glimpsed a distant patrol, I grew contemptuous of them, believing their ineffectiveness to be a part of that general disorganization I had observed in the Commonwealth so often. With or without my help, Vodalus, I felt, would surely destroy such bunglers. Indeed, could do so now, if he would only strike. And yet, the androgyne in the yellow robe, who had known Vodalus's password and received his message as if expecting it, was unquestionably the Autarch, the master of those soldiers, and in fact of the entire Commonwealth, insofar as it recognized a master. Thecla had seen him often. Those memories of Thecla's were now my own, and it was he. If Vodalus had won already, why did he remain in hiding? Or was Vodalus merely a creature of the Autarch's? If so, why did Vodalus refer to the Autarch as though he were a servitor? I tried to persuade myself that everything that had passed in the chamber of the picture and the rest of the second house had been a dream, but I knew it was not so, and the steel was gone. Thinking of Vodalus reminded me of the claw, which the Autarch himself had urged me to return to the order of priestesses called Pelerines. I drew it out. Its light was soft now, neither flashing as it had been in the mine of the man-apes, nor dull as it had been when Jonas and I had examined it in the antechamber. Though it lay upon the palm of my hand, it seemed to me now a great pool of blue water, purer than the cistern, purer far than Gaol, into which I might dive, though in doing so I should in some incomprehensible fashion be diving up. It was at once comforting and disquieting, and I pushed it into my boot top again and walked on. Dawn found me on a narrow path that straggled through a forest more sumptuous in its decay even than that outside the wall of Nessus. The cool fern arches I had seen there were absent here, but fleshy-fingered vines clung to the great mahoganies and rain trees like hetairae, turning their long limbs to clouds of floating green and lowering rich curtains spangled with flowers. Birds unknown to me called overhead, and once a monkey, who might, save for his four hands, have been a wizened, red-bearded man in fur, spied on me from a fork as high as a spire. When I could walk no farther, I found a dry, well-shaded spot between pillar-thick roots and wrapped myself in my cloak. Often I had to hunt down sleep, as though it were the most elusive of chimeras, half legend and half air. Now it sprang upon me. I had no sooner closed my eyes than I faced the maddened giant again. This time I held Terminus Est, but she seemed no more than a wand. Instead of the stage, we stood upon a narrow parapet. To one side flamed the torches of an army, on the other a sheer drop, terminated in a spreading lake that at once was and was not the azure pool of the claw. Baldanders lifted his terrible flambeau, and I had somehow become the childish figure I had seen beneath the sea. The gigantic women, I felt, could not be far away. The mace crashed down. It was broad afternoon, and flame-colored ants were making a caravan across my chest. After two or three watches spent in walking among the pale leaves of that noble yet doomed forest, I struck a broader path, and in another watch, when the shadows were lengthening, I halted, sniffed the air, and found that the odor I had detected was indeed the reek of smoke. I was racked with hunger by that time, and I hurried forward.